to something that we've been speaking about with Rabbi Brennspiegel. And I know that in America, it became a cause celebre, and I told you last week, and I guess some of you already heard from America, that over 320 Talmidim published an ad supporting Rabbi Brennspiegel, etc. But I think what the problem is, and I think that I'm correct in this, it's not so much the academic freedom, but that Rabbi Brennspiegel has used the eulogy of the Rav to attack Torah Umata. And I think this is where Rabbi Lam is upset, or those that are upset with Rabbi Brennspiegel, because you can do whatever you want with Torah Umata. You can attack it from today to tomorrow. And someone told me as I was walking to class that Rabbi Schechter attacks Torah Umata. You can make a long list of Rosh Yeshiv and YU who attack Torah Umata. However, attack on your own. Don't put those words into the Rav, or imply that it has something to do with the Rav. And I think that's why this became a cause celebre. And the truth of the matter is that I got a letter in the mail. These letters, I still keep my record clear of having answered every letter that I ever received. But I got a number of letters while I was in America. It's unbelievable, all the mail I got that I wish I would have gotten it before I left for America, because I could have taken care of it while I was in America. And instead, when I came back, it was all there, and it's three times as hard to take care of something from here when you can do it in America. But anyway, among the letters I received, for instance, the tombstone of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, someone found out that I have a picture, and I deciphered the tombstone. Someone in down south, Memphis, Tennessee, sent me a stamped envelope. Anyway, so today I photographed the tombstone, I photographed my deciphering of it, and I sent that back. That was relatively easy. Someone from me, Yeshiva, sends me a letter. He heard my talk via tape of my critique of Modern Orthodoxy of 2 years ago, and he pleads with me. He writes about five questions, if I would be good enough to answer them. Well, to answer all five questions would have taken me 20 hours and 500 sheets of paper. So I wrote back to him that I never defend myself. I don't care. Halavai should be absolutely wrong. But I said, if you want to, and I can see from the letter that this person is no one's fool, and that certain things I said, and then he heard some of my tapes about Reform and Conservative, so I see he's enthralled with this Aaron Rakefet. But the last thing I want to do is, you know, if you're in Mir Yeshiva, you're learning in Mir Zeitgesund, I wrote to him, if you want to come study with me and get to know me, I invited him to sit 10 years in this class and 4 years in the other class, and we will become friends. But among the questions he asked was, what was the Rav's attitude towards Torah Umata? You know, with all they're seeing in America, what's the truth? So I answered him, get hold of the tape that I recreated, that I began last Tuesday, and tomorrow I come to the heart of it, and word by word you'll hear the Rav's attitude. And this is the amazing thing about the tapes, that ultimately it's just what I told you. Remember last year, Jacob, when I eulogized the Rav at the end of the year, I said, no matter what people are saying about the Rav, ultimately, the real Rav will ring out, because he left so many tapes that there's no way. All you have to know is Yiddish, because the majority of his masterful talks are in Yiddish. But this talk that I'm recreating from 56, the one I'm going to do from 69, your hair will stand on edge. And that's the Rav. And here's the good news. I was just told on Shabbat that a $10 million center is going to be built in Boston, dedicated in memory of the Rav, that's just going to be devoted to deciphering his tapes. So all I can say is, we were born too soon. Had we been born, if we were born 10 years from now, you can imagine, it's just what I predicted. I'm not so stupid, you don't have to be overly smart either, but just what I predicted. Like the Vilna Gaon, 100 volumes ultimately were written from his Kitvei Yad, from his Gemaras, from his Shulchan Aruchs, from his here goes. Sit, Nathan, give the two ladies this table and shift over here. So, just like I said, that 100 volumes were written from the Vilna Gaon, and Be'ezrat Hashem, you'll see 50 years from now, 100 years from now, you'll have over 100 volumes from the tapes, and thank God it's being done properly. They're going to have a centralized place. It's going to be built on the Maimonides campus, going to have proper equipment, proper Talmidei Chachamim, and ultimately decipher these tapes. Okay, so that's vis-a-vis the Rav, and that's what I really think the problem is. It's not academic freedom, But it's the fact that when you're eulogizing the Rav and you become sarcastic and Torah Mada, so people forget where the eulogy of the Rav ends and where your own Hashkafa begins. I would like to believe that in YU there's academic freedom and that a Rebbe can get up and maledict Torah Mada and no one's going to call him to terms. But if you maledict Torah Mada in the middle of a eulogy on the Rav, I can understand what Rabbi Lam is upset. Okay, Avraham, yes. No, Beseder, I heard many Hespedim via tape, and if you put all the Hespedim together, the most amazing thing is how the Rav was so great that he made so many Talmidim who claim he was a Rebbe Mufak, and each Talmud saw the Rav differently. It shows greatness in the man. Now, yeah, Avraham, the Rav to give their own Hashkafa, but everyone claimed that their Hashkafa was the Hashkafa of the Rav. I understand. So you're absolutely right. I read Rabbi Lichtenstein's eulogy of the Rav, and it literally was a description of Ramaz. And you know something? There were moments when the Rav spoke like that too. The truth was, the Rav, I claim, if you study in my Rabbi Soloveitchik course, at the end of 3 years, you'll have a good handle on who the Rav was. That's my claim. What I'm doing now, no one can find fault with, because it's literally the Rav, and I have to give Nordlich all the credit in the world. He made that tape available. And there's the Rav discussing, we begin tomorrow, why I identify with YU. Okay, now, we begin Tuesday, I mean. Now, let's come back to this class. That was only a ha'ara, because people are talking about it now, and the big full page ad and the commentator, and the students are at war, and you know, nothing adds to a year in YU than a little war between faculty, Rosh Yeshiva, administration, students. If someone didn't create it, they'd have to invent it anyway, because no one is going to forget this advertisement. And I have to tell you, they sent carbon copies, Rabbi Lam, Rabbi Chalap, Rabbi Schwartz. Rabbi Schwartz is my comment, so I asked Alan, how come your name is on here? How did you rate a carbon copy of the ad, so of the open letter? So he told me, because he criticized Rabbi Braunschweigel. So anyone in YU who criticized Rabbi Braunschweigel got in the advertisement it reads, copies were sent to. Now, I want to come back here. By the way, there's a class list passing around. I'm going to make a new list for this term because, again, and ultimately they asked me who was here, who wasn't here. So with the terms, the class changed. So please see that you're signed in. Now, if anyone's not signed in, raise your hand. If anyone's here and not signed in, then give the list back to me. Now, last week's shiur, I cannot tell you, when all is said and done, I cannot tell you how important last week's shiur was from the sense of paskening halacha, the subjective factor in paskening a halacha. And this is what the Shach and the Ramah are driving at. When all is said and done, the Moradiatra is the Moradiatra, and we absolutely have to depend upon the local Rav if he's a Talmud Chacham. And that's the Gemara in Chulin Daf Zayin that we quoted, Ein Mezichin Oto, that no matter what a Talmud Chacham says, no matter what he paskens, you cannot ipso facto invalidate him because his psak sounds odd, queer, innovative. And that's the Gemara, that's the Miri, Mokam Hinichalo Avatavli Hitkaderbo. And I showed you examples from the Yerushalmi. I mean, magnificent examples. And the example with Rav Urbach and the terrible problem of AIH, B'yamei Nidata, and the tube and everything we spoke about last week, that the woman shouldn't be a nida, the oraita, this is very innovative thinking. Why is Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach going way out on a limb? Because imagine the tragedy of a woman who cannot conceive a child because she observes Tanat Mishpacha. See, this is a tragedy. That a woman is normal and healthy and the man is normal and healthy, and because of statistical reasons, she cannot conceive. And this is why Rav Shlomo Zalman does what he does. And even though Rav Kasha, again what I showed you, Rav Kasha doesn't agree with him totally, but he says, halach l'maisa, with AIH it solves the problem. And this is an example of where a great Rav is doing everything he can because he feels the terrible subjective pressure of the tragedy of these individual women. And as I told you, halachic literature was haunted by this problem in the 20th century. Once we understand, you got to remember, years ago, no one understood the way biology works, the way hygiene works, etc. But it's already about 100 years that we understand this problem, and there never was a solution. Then came AIH. And then came the big machlokit be made nidata. If you take the Zohar, Masvuta, and these are serious matters, and the machlokit the Minchat Yitzchak and Reb Moshe Feinstein, then what I told you, the difference between America and Israel, and I stand on that difference. You should know, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein once had this shayla halacha lamaisa in the early 70s or mid 70s. He came to me, he said, what should I paskin? And I told him, Aaron, here in Israel, paskin like the Minchat Yitzchak. In America, you paskin like Reb Moshe Feinstein. But he had paskin like the Minchat Yitzchak. Then Hananya Berzon, there was a Rabbi Berzon, taught here, the Shaila came up again, maybe in the early 80s with an AIH, and we were able to solve the problem with Shaarei Tzaddik. And imagine the feeling to bring a child into the world through a psak halacha. It's a beautiful feeling. And Ashreinu Shezachim Lekach. Now, this concept of the Rav, and he can be machmir where others were mekil, he can be mekil where others were machmir, and ultimately it all boils down to the subjective feeling of the Rav, and the Shach, the Ramah, and all of Psak hinges on this. I like the example I gave you. It came up today, I have to be honest with you, I always could not fathom women's prayer groups. It was beyond my concept. And today, in a different class, in a different school, we were discussing the Vilna Gaon before he went in Aliyah. So the Vilna Gaon left a document. It's a classic document. If you haven't studied it, you have to study it. Alimdur Trufa. My daughters studied in high school, but these American girls, I don't know what high schools they went to, but believe me, they didn't study the Vilna Gaon's Alimdur Trufa in the various high schools they went to, even though some of them are good high schools, Brewery, etc. But Alim L'Trufa leaves that heel. You know what's beautiful about that document? Here's the great Vilna Gaon, the greatest mind that lived in the last 200 years. The document is so human. It's 1783. He's going in Aliyah. And what is he worried about? His mother and daughter and wife getting along. In other words, even the Vilna Gaon, his wife, Jacob passed this back to Shlomo. Even the Vilna Gaon, his wife couldn't get along with his mother. And he's pleading with them, while I'm gone, don't fight, please be considerate, my mother is older. In other words, a younger woman who has some brains has to understand that sometimes you have to defer to age. But there's another part of the document, who knows, where the Vilna Gaon, go ahead, Gadi. Right, he tells his wife, don't let our daughter go to shul. Because what's going to happen in shul, all that happens is the women don't daven and they talk Lashon Hara, and she sees the other girls in beautiful new dresses, and she'll come home and she'll want the new dresses. We don't have money to afford the dresses. Don't let her go to shul to daven. So I want to tell you, a woman said to me, which is better? We should go to shul and daven and no women daven and they talk and they gossip and it's a fashion parade, or we have our own women's prayer group. And when I read the Alim L'Trufa this morning, I had to say that that woman made a very convincing case. But, again, this is what we call subjectivity. It's very hard to paskin a shayla like that from afar. When you understand and you're part of it, you can feel very differently about it. And that's the Raman the Shach. And halacha l'maisa, I'll only say that my own feeling is, and I haven't changed my mind, it's not that I think women's prayer groups are the answer, or should be encouraged, but if women want it, there's no way you can say no. And certainly to work it out halachically. And I, you know, the way they've worked it out already, Reb Moshe has a tshuva, it was already worked out with Reb Moshe in the early 70s, and that's the way they daven, and they're very committed, you know, they do nothing against halacha. I asked them, how do you have chazaras hashatz? So they told me the woman who says the Shmoneh Esrei aloud doesn't say it silently. She waits until everyone finishes, then she says the Shmoneh Esrei aloud. Birchat HaTorah was the old solution, that they don't make Birchat HaTorah in the morning, any woman who's getting an Aliyah, so they make the Birchat HaTorah before the Aliyah. The Haftorah I caught them on, because they were saying Brachat of that. Yeah, what's your problem? Well, say that a woman has a problem? A woman can do whatever she wants. You don't. You have a problem. She has no problem. Shalom Asani, a woman says Asani Kiritzono. The minute you say Shalom Shani Yisha, at that moment your problems begin. You follow me? Yeah, but that's only b'diavad. They have a right to say the bracha openly, even after Avarap, if they wish. But say, I don't know, this is Rav Moshe, I mean, they claim this worked out with Rav Moshe, so don't quibble with me. But what I did catch them on, Jason, was the Haftorah. They said they were saying it with the brachat, and I said, how can you say it with brachat? So the rabbi sitting there who worked a lot said he didn't know this. I said, well, you better check it out, because I can't see how women can say brachat on the Haftorah if they have no chiyav to read the Haftorah l'chatchilah. And that's what they do. There's no Kaddish. I said, so what is the greatness of this if you can't say Kaddish and you can't say Kedusha? So they answered, the greatness is that there's no disturbance. They can daven. It's not a fashion show, etc. Okay, I don't know, but I'm not here to say, that it's an ideal, but on the other hand, we cannot be cynical, we cannot be sarcastic. And I have to say, if they're hearing it from these women, and one of the women was the daughter of one of the, I don't want to mention who it is, you shouldn't identify, suffice it to say, her father was one of the greatest Hasidic Rebbeim in the first half of the 20th century, and this is a fact. And her father was a gon and a tzaddik and a world-renowned Hasidic Rebbe, and this woman is, no youngster. She has 15 grandchildren. She's in her 60s. And she was describing it with such enthusiasm that it was moving for me to hear it. And that's why I said last week that's exactly what the Shach and the Ramah are talking about. Okay. But now I want to go further, and I want to take a different topic. And this topic is a fascinating halachic topic. And I'll show you a lot of Makorah today. I don't think we're not going to finish the entire topic today. You'll understand why later. Now, when you paskin a shaila, you always have to fear one tremendous problem. Perhaps if you paskin with the straight halacha, but a takala can happen. Something can go wrong. Even though your psak is right, a takala can happen. Now, I'll give you an example. I'll give you a funny example, and then I'll show you much more serious examples. A shaila that always used to come out, and I always use this as an example, it depends upon who's asking you. Let me tell a story. I told the story a year ago, but I might as well repeat the story. Story with Rabbi Soloveitchik. I'm an eyewitness to this. It has to be, let's say, the late 50s, early 60s. I come into the graduate school office. There was a lady in the graduate school office. At that time, there was no Touro College, and Dr. Bernard Lander ran the graduate school in YU. He was a YU person. Who would believe that this man would undermine YU in later years? But that's the way history works. Dr. Bernard Lander was dean of the graduate school. Dr. Bernard Lander always did three things at once. You can only succeed in life when you do three things at once if you have a good secretary. He had Mrs. Pearl Cotton, was a widow. She was the recorder of the graduate school. They didn't call her secretary, they called her recorder. They gave her a title. She ran the graduate school. She was the most efficient, most wonderful woman you could imagine. Not only that, she used to put the pin into the students. Meaning, when you walked in, she reminded you, you didn't take this class, you didn't do that class, your work is over, then when are you going to finish your thesis, your dissertation? She kept the needle in. So before Pesach, I went in to wish her a freilich and a kosher in Pesach, as any men should do before Pesach. I come in, and it's the old Bernard Revel, it's the old little building, and there is Mrs. Cotton in tears. And I say, what happened, Mrs. Cotton? And she said, oh, she says to me, Arnold, you wouldn't believe this. She mentions to me a student, I don't want to mention his name, she says, I offered in my hand, he came in to wish me a freilichin and kosher in Pesach, and I offered in my hand, and he wouldn't shake it. And she says, 10 minutes ago, Rabbi Soloveitchik was here, and he wished me a freilichin and kosher in Pesach, and I offered in my hand, and he shook my hand. And this student embarrassed me so, Rabbi Soloveitchik can take my hand, and this student, I don't want to use the word, she called him a dash nose, and this student can't take my hand, and she was so upset. So the halacha is, it is a serious question, if a woman offers you your hand, what do you do? So let me assure you that in BMT, I would never pass in the shayla in accordance with what I really believe. For one simple reason, Could you imagine for a BMT boy, you're paskin, well, if a woman offers you your hand, you can take it, not to embarrass her. So now the BMT boy goes to work. He's on a date with his girlfriend from Machon Gold. He's telling her a good Devar Torah as he walks through the triangle in the center of town. And every second step, she's offering him her hand to give him a Yashar Koyach. You understand? That's what you call a takala from Paskin Yishela. And now you have to use common sense. Depending upon who asks you and the context with which it's asked, that's where you can Paskin. But this is a serious question. With the example I gave you, I'm absolutely convinced that I cannot paskin honestly. I have to hedge my bet, and I have to tell him that if the woman is under 70, chas v'chalila, you should take her hand. If the woman is under 70 and she's not your mother, grandmother, or aunt, chas v'chalila, you should take her hand if she offers you her hand to give you asher kayach. But that's when it comes to this particular topic in the BMT context. Here for 20 years and knowing BMT mentality. Now, Saul, I see you're recording it. Now, what about for real? Let me give you... Ellie, I've been teaching all day. Have mercy. Let me give you a real example. This example, I have to be honest with you, whenever it comes to a question like that, Nathan knows, you have to think ahead because a BMT boy is also thinking ahead. So, and his mind is just as innovative as yours. But now I want to give it to you on... Now I want to ask a serious question. Here I am going to Moscow the first time. And I'm very frightened. Moscow is cold. What about gloves on Shabbat? And this is a classic example. There is not one mucker in all of Shas. Not one mucker. Jason. Not one mucker of all of Shas that it's forbidden to wear gloves on Shabbat. Maybe they didn't have gloves at the time of Chazal. Maybe where the Jews lived in Palestine and Babylonia, there was no need for gloves. Now, nevertheless, we find in Chazal, they were worried time and again, Shema Yavirenu, Dalet Amit B'Shutarabim. Don't we refrain from blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah, Shema Yavirenu? And if you're worried about a shofar Shema Yavirenu, gloves, a million times more. Not only that, etiquette calls for taking off your gloves when you meet someone. Right or wrong, taking off your gloves. No, you're wearing gloves, you take off your gloves, you shake hands, right? It's not nice to give someone a hand with a glove on it. And then you walk away. And it seems to me with gloves on Shabbat where there's no Erev, the problem of Shema Yavirenu is really a real problem. And yeah, I'm raising the problem. Yes, you got, yeah? I can't hear Shlomo. People shake hands with gloves on, I'm happy to hear it, but the gentleman would keep that etiquette. I don't know if you're right or wrong. I feel awkward when I don't take a glove off. I feel like I'm embarrassing the person. Now, this is the key example. Do you worry about wearing gloves, Bereshit HaRabim? Don't you? And here we come to a very basic rule. Me'ika hadin, if the gezeira was not made by the time of the Rishonim, we are not allowed to make gezeira today. This is a basic concept in Psak Halacha. And all these fears that you're going to worry about side happenings, possible bad effects, cause and effect, all these fears have absolutely no validity. You have to paskin what halacha is, and it could very well be if there's no gezeira against wearing gloves, you have every right to wear gloves. Now, in relation to gloves, if you look into the Mishnah Berurah, you'll see some machlokes achronim. The truth is that some of the achronim tried to subsume this under the earlier gezeira, so the issue is not so simple. I can only tell you that where I grew up in New York, I never wore gloves on Shabbos. When I went to Moscow, I wore gloves. I was matineder. No one's around who was. I made a bait and I was matineder for two reasons. One, I never was in such a cold place. And two, since there's nobody I know in Moscow, I don't think the fear of meeting the KGB in the street, I'm going to take off my gloves to shake hands with them. But it's a machlekes achronim. Nowadays in New York, I'm mekil to wear gloves. Can anyone tell me why? When I'm in Manhattan, I wore gloves a few weeks ago. The weather was like Moscow, but that's not the reason I wore gloves. Can anyone tell me why? Why does that make ill to wear gloves? Because there's a machleket, whether there's an Erev, not an Erev. Many say there is an Erev, new, so that much into the Samach on the Erev, to wear a watch and to wear gloves. You follow me? You have to think like a London. If there wouldn't be an Erev altogether, I have a problem. But if many claim there's an Erev, that much I can be Samach. Now, that's the classic example. Where did this problem come up? Or just let me say before I begin, I think there's something I told you before, but let me reiterate it so there should be no mistake. Our entire discussion today is on Gezerot. As far as Tachanot go, every Beit Din has the power to make Tachanot. The power of Tachanot has never ended. And in the state of Israel, for the sake of argument, if a kid of 17 gives a girl a candy bar in front of two Eidim and says, Haret Mukudeshet, and the boy is 17 and the girl is 16, they can be thrown into jail for going against the Takana of the Chief Rabbinate from 1960, that you have to be 18 years old to get married. In 1950, the Chief Rabbinate made a Takana, you have to be 17 years old to get married. In 1960, they upped it 10 years, and who knows, the way life is going and we live so much longer, could be in a few years' time, they'll make a takana, you can't get married under 19, under 20, and that's a takana. It's a simple example of a takana. It's for the social, moral, economic well-being of the Jewish people. We're too young at the age of 18 today. Could you imagine a boy is making a decision to get married? It's a little too young. And yet, al pi halacha, when a boy is 13, Ribbono shel Olam, he gives a girl a candy bar with two witnesses and says, "Aret mukudeshet li b'candy bar zu kedat moshev Yisrael." She is married 1,000,000%. So that takana. I give you another example of a takana. The Eid Haredit, all you know with Shviat, what's going on. So the Eid Haredit suddenly puts up signs: no one is allowed to buy green peppers until the price drops. Because on Shviat there's always a problem. The Arabs know they have a monopoly. They raise the price. And the Eid Haredit, if they're the ones bringing in the green peppers, they have a right to say, don't buy them until the price drops. And that's a takana. And we have many examples in response literature. Can anyone tell me, Nu, what's the classic tshuva on this topic that I just drew out to you? Excuse me? Fish on Shabbos. Who's the meshiv exactly? Reb Menachem Mendel Krachma, the first Tzemach Tzedek. Not the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but the first Tzemach Tzedek from the 17th century. He has the classic tshuva where the Goyim raised the price and he said, don't buy fish for Shabbos, even though al Pizoa you have to have fish in Shabbos, but it's a disgrace. Takonot continued today, Gezerot don't. Now where did this come up? And I'll just introduce the topic, I'll just mention the topic now, but I'm going to deal with it in great length later today and next week. This topic came up in the United States when you were little boys running around in short pants, knives from Jews, were killing each other, shooting each other, slaughtering each other, and what's the catchword for why they were doing it? The Erev in Brooklyn. Now, when this Erev in Brooklyn came up, all halachic feeling broke loose, and it was shooting on all sides. Now, the Erev in Brooklyn was not the first machloket. The original machloket goes back to the 1950s with the Erev in Manhattan. And you have to remember, there's a long history of Erevim in Manhattan. The turn of the century, they made an Erev on the east side. So much has been written. And then, with the post-World War II crowd and the Upper West Side and so many from Jews living in the Upper West Side and the Boli Yisrael living there, Reb Menachem Kasha, a tremendous move got underway to make an Erev for Manhattan. And I'm not going into any halachic questions now. I'm just dealing with one problem at this moment because the topic is unbelievably fascinating and I'll deal with it in great length later. It's one of the most fascinating topics. The Erev of Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, Detroit, Muncie, where yes, where no, Reb Moshe's viewpoint, it's a fascinating topic. But when people opposed the Erev of Manhattan, one of the reasons they gave was a very simple reason. And I can give it to you black and white. My grandchildren have no idea that it's forbidden to carry on Shabbat. For them, it is totally theoretical. They were born, bred, raised in Yerushalayim. All their life, they've been carrying on Shabbat. My daughter, for the first time in her life, when she moved into Pisgat Zev Mizrach, for the first time in her life, she couldn't carry on Shabbat because the Ravnid had not yet extended the Erev to Pisgat Zev Mizrach. Now, Baruch Hashem, the Erev is extended and they have a deal with, you know, the Erev is not knocked down by the Arabs. There's a deal with the Qadis and with the that it's a religious matter, and the Hamas, the fanatic Muslims, should respect the Jewish religion so they don't destroy the Erev. The only time we had a problem with the Erev last, I think Yaakov will remember, is when we had the tremendous snowstorms and the Erev simply was knocked down by the snow, by the ice, which is a problem. And on the radio, they announced already from the 2 o'clock news on Erev Shabbos that there will be no Erev this Shabbat. The Erev is down. And it was, we explained to the kids, this is the way we lived in America and in Gullis, and they were looking at us. And now, so then the question, you know, and it was a big, big chiddush for them that you can't carry, you have to think in advance. And, you know, my daughter lives right near us, my eldest daughter, we moved the food back and forth, everything had to be moved before Shabbat. It was a big chiddush for them. Those who opposed the Erev said, hey, wait a minute, we're going to have an Erev in Manhattan. Manhattan has hundreds of thousands of Jews. Ribbono shel Olam, all these people are going to now grow up in Manhattan, they're going to carry on Shabbos, going to wheel baby carriages on Shabbos. Then they're going to move to an area where there's no Erev. They will never know it's forbidden to carry. No? What type of thinking is this? What's the halachic rubric? Gezerah. In other words, let's, just like the boy in BMT, except now it's much more serious. The boy in BMT says, Rebbe, what do I do? This woman offered me her hand. So, I should pass him. The woman offered you her hand. She wants to shake hands. You don't want to embarrass her. I saw my Rebbe. My Rebbe shook Mrs. Cotton's hand. It's well known that if a woman offered her hand, there were many literature who were mekil. But I'm worried stiff. And that's why I answer him, how old was the woman? Under 70? Just explain to her that your Rebbe said, you're not allowed to shake a hand. It's not to embarrass her, but it's because you don't embarrass yourself. You understand? But that's only in that area. Now we come to the Erev. It's a serious question. And here I can't play tricks, and here I can't play games. Do we have to worry? 100,000 boys and girls will be raised in Manhattan, and they'll move away to Omaha, Nebraska. They'll move away to Kalamazoo, Michigan. They'll move away to, I don't know, any other area you can mention where there is no Erev. They'll move away to Kharkov to be Makarov Jews in Russia. They'll move to the Ukraine, to Lithuania today. Jews are moving all over. They'll move to London. There's no Erev in London, to the best of my knowledge. And they'll move to Chicago. There's no Erev in Chicago, to the best of my knowledge. Excuse me? There is. I know there's a whole machloket, but it shows you how weak in Rabban Soloveitchik's position is that they're putting, that they were able to do something with the Erev. Young men and ladies, do we have to worry? This is a gezeira. Worrying about what may happen, what may happen, what may happen. Gentlemen, on this issue, there's a very important shiva of one of the gedolei haposkim, Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank. Noam, Chelik Gimel, page Shin Tetzayin, 316, Shin Tetzayin. And here's what happened. When the big machloket broke out in New York in the early 50s about putting an Erev around Manhattan, they wrote to Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank. Now, Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank was not only the Rav of Yerushalayim, but he was one of those Rabbanim who had total acceptance. I know it's hard for you to understand in the world in which we live. Everyone knows that in Litvish circles they go to one Rav, in Hasidish circles another Rav, in Sionistish the Zionists go to another Rav, the YU circles go to another Rav. About, if I can give you an example of who Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank was, I can give you one simple answer: Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach is revered in all circles. If anyone doesn't revere him, smack his face and tell him, I told you to do it. Okay? But Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank was a person, you understand, on that level. Born in Lithuania, came to Eretz Yisrael, a gonadir, an a posek mupak, a giant of Yirat Shemayim. The only fault you could find with him is that in his youth he had some Zionist tendencies. In other words, in his youth it's reported he was not only a Zionist, but even a bit of a revisionist. But listen, you know what they used to say, if you weren't a communist in your youth, you haven't lived. In his youth, he was an extreme Zionist. Later in life, he became, he cooled off a little, but he was persona grata, agudist. Listen, shichmo lamala mikolam, I think that says it all. So Rav Menachem Kasha turned to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. So this tshuva is amazing. He writes that I refuse to get involved with the Manhattan Erev. I've never been to Manhattan. I've never seen Manhattan. I hear conflicting opinions about the rabbis there. Who am I sitting in Yerushalayim to get involved in a question so far away? But he says, what I am willing to write is one simple matter. And this is beautiful. He says, recently my friend the great Gaon HaRav Menachem Kasha visited me in Yerushalayim. And as we were speaking, he told me about many people, and listen to his words, Shekva amru harishonim she'ein lanu ligzog kreis tzeirot biatzmeinu. And he goes on, and he says very simply that with all the possible takolot, and it can very well be, a person is raised in Jerusalem, he moves to London, in London there's no Erev, the first Shabbat there, he walks out with his pockets filled with tissues, with his keys in his pocket, his wife comes out with a baby carriage, wheeling the baby, and suddenly they come to shul, and everyone tells them, what are you, crazy? We don't have an Erev here, you can't wheel a baby carriage. Fine, it's a takala. But because of that, you cannot change the halacha. Gezeirot have no place in our thinking if they were not stated 1,000 years ago. And he ends off the tshuva, you see, it's very fascinating. Of course, you can see from between the lines that he was absolutely in favor of the Erev in Manhattan. He ends off the tshuva, Im kein mikol shekein to Manhattan, shanechitzut l'tikun Erevin gedolah miyad, because let's face it, how many people carried in Manhattan? You understand what I'm saying? How many good Jews come to shul? I was once amazed, I don't want to mention one of the most prominent Israeli families, famous Rabbanim, Chavrei Knesset from Agudat Israel. And this is a woman from that family, doesn't live in Israel. Her father already lived in a different country, was a Rebbe in a different country. She married a very wonderful Jew, world-class Jew. And I meet her in a city where there's no Erev, and she's carrying a handkerchief on Shabbos. She says, it's Pikuach Nefesh, how can you not go with her? You understand? So how many good, and this is a good Jewish woman who raised good Jewish children. How many good Jewish people? The problem of the handkerchief, the keys. In New York, it's a real problem, because if you had only one key, you can turn it into a tie clip. But in New York, you have three keys on your door. Ribbono shel Olam, what goes on? And even with all the locks in the world, you're still not safe from the drug pushers and the drug users who need a quick fix, meaning money to get to, etc. So with so many keys, what do you do? There's real problems. And what about the babies and the children and the mothers? And he says, Nechitzut gedola miyad. Bevadai, kol ha-mesayim le-mitzvah rabezu, shchut harabim yagen aleihem, al hosim v'hama'asim. And he says very simply that it's very needed, and the whole tshuva shows that there's no reason to be concerned with the gezeira. We do not make up gezeira today. Ein gozrin gezeirat, and adarabah, if you hold you can make an Erev, it's a great mitzvah, and as he says, that mitzvah will protect those who do, and it's a play on words, osim v'hama'asim, and their deeds as well. So you see between the lines that that Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank was certainly in favor of the Erev in Manhattan. However, very cunningly or very intelligently, He doesn't want to take a clear stand because he's so many thousand miles away, and while getting involved in a machloket where so many Gedolei Yisrael are arguing so vociferously with each other. Okay, now where do we see? So this is Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. This is a contemporary. This is a person who died, I believe, 1960. So basically we're dealing with a contemporary. But where do we see the sources? Young people, the sources go all the way back to the Gaonic period. Let me quote to you from Sefer Chemda Gnuza. Now, a word on Gaonica, because Gaonica, one of my closest friend in life, is one of the ranking experts in the world on Gaonica. You know who I'm talking about? Zvi Groner, Professor Zvi Groner. Unfortunately, he cannot work anymore. He has a Kogan syndrome, which even the doctors among you have never heard of. If you just didn't know what Kogan syndrome is, talk with me after class. But it's a syndrome for which they have no cure, and it's not life-threatening, but it certainly at times can be simply he can't get out. Can be debilitating at times. I've mispronounced it, but I don't have the time now to recorrect myself. Let it stand. I saw Uri choked. Now, debilitating. Do I have it? Let me hear. Debilitating without the H? Live and learn. Debilitating. Write it out for me, give it to me after class. Okay. Anyway, now, Gaonic is a very fascinating topic. I'll tell you why it's so fascinating. Beginning with the Cairo Geniza, there was tremendous impetus with discovery of endless tshuvot from the Gaonic period. Until today, we still have every few years more and more tshuvot being discovered. Rabbi Binyamin Menashe Levin, who of course edited the classic work Otzer Gaonim, we today need a great Gaon who would build upon the Otzer Gaonim and add all the material that has been discovered in the last 70 years since Rabbi Binyamin Menashe Levin did the Otzer Gaonim. And this is what makes Gaonica a very fascinating topic, but so many different sources. Now, many volumes appeared with manuscripts published. Sefer Chemda Gnuza is one of the examples. I'm quoting from Chemda Gnuza, Tshuvot HaGaonim, Siman Ayin Zayin. And it's a very fascinating question. What's the question? No. What did I tell you? It's the mirror image of the question I told you about in America. Remember I told you when I was in America for Thanksgiving Day, my wife brings home a bread, and on the bread it says KD. And my brother-in-law gets all upset because it doesn't have an OU. What does a K mean? I look at the bread and I see it's Arnold Bakery, and I say to my brother-in-law, you have nothing to worry about. It cannot be that Arnold's Bakery does not have a good heksher. I pick up a phone to Mr. Kashrut in America, Rabbi Manny Holzer, and he tells me something amazing. Wherever there is an OU on a bread company and they make products that have dairy, they don't want to put the OU on the products because it's a machlekes hapoiskim and people will start saying the OU is not reliable. The whole question, you're not allowed to make bread with milk in it unless you make a special simen on the bread that it is milchiks. Why aren't you allowed to make bread with milk in it? Because Gadi will come home, take meat, and grab the nearest piece of bread, and he will wind up eating Pasav HaChalav. Shlomo, so the OU solves the problem. They turn the OU into a KD. So all the effort who say, if it says KD and the wrapper is clear that it's dairy, in the world we know that bread can hook in itself. The wrapper reads KD, it's the biggest simon in the world. It's like writing on the bread dairy, but they don't want to sully the name of the OU. So they leave it KD. Gentlemen, fine. That gezeira already, it has makorot going way back. But now take the mirror image. Someone made a beautiful cake, and in the cake, they used schmaltz, chicken fats. All the Jewish stand-up comedians always tell the stories when we were growing up. What did we live on? What made you healthy? the schmaltz. Your grandmother gave you schmaltz, es mein kind es. Panay, we know, the more schmaltz you ate, the more cholesterol, the more you ruined your heart, the more you destroyed your body. But nevertheless, growing up 50, 60 years ago, schmaltz. Now, could you imagine, we now have a nice, beautiful bread, and we want you to be healthy, and we want Jay Pasner to live and be well, so his wife wants him to have energy and strength, and she makes beautiful bread with chicken fats, with schmaltz. Are you allowed? And what's the problem? It's the mirror image. No one finishes a whole bread at once. You make a bread, you have it today with meat, and tomorrow you're having cheese, and inadvertently you see the bread, and you grab the bread and eat the fleishik of bread with the cheese. Are you allowed to make meat bread, meat cookies, use schmaltz instead of margarine, instead of oil? Unbelievable. The mirror image of the yo-yo's question. I don't know of anyone, and maybe you can correct me, I don't know. Any of you gourmet cooks, gourmet bakers, do they make bread anywhere in the world with schmaltz today, with meat today? I don't know. But here we have it. Ayin Zayin. And this is written by a gom. It was found in manuscript. And he says, V'lasot uga lahaniach betocha alya o basash shuman she'atem choshishim migazrin and shem yisheh petitin v'yachlein im hagvina. Exactly what I described to you. The leave-over part of the bread. The list I choose to, just give me a second. If the first rabbis didn't make the gezeira, chas v'chalila, we don't add any gezeira b'zman hazen. This is a gaon speaking. And he says, shafilu davar sheyesh lachush lo yoter, v'yesh b'davar lachachmir, v'ein anu choshishin. And this is a gaon speaking. And he says, this is a wide chash. Most of us are smart enough to know, if I have milchika bread, I keep it in one place. If I have fleishika cookies, I'll keep it in another place. Most of us are smart enough so that the chance of something happening here is very minute. But he says, even where it makes a lot of sense, even where it stares you in the eye, even where it appears very real, nevertheless, we're not allowed to make a gezeira. The only gezeira we have, Elamashe Gazru and Sheik Neset HaGadola, but they didn't gedolim, Sharei Amru Chachamim, Bekame Mekomot, Gezeira Le Gezeira, Lo Gazrin. Listen to these words very carefully. V'yim kein, nitmalei gezeirat, U'ma'asim b'chal yom, osim kein, V'lo machu b'yadam, Rabbanoteinu harishonim. Now, what does this mean? These are the words of a gaon. You know, you're not talking here a nachron, you're not talking even a rishon, you're talking a gaon. And I think what he's saying is very simple. That halavai we could keep the gezerat we have. We already have enough gezerat. If we start adding more gezerat, yahadut will become impossible. And the truth is, he's right. When you look at yahadut, the Torah that we live today, 90% of what we do is gezeirat. You can take any example. Take Shabbat. All of us feel Shabbat muktza. To me, there's nothing more to Shabbat than muktza. How many times are you going to turn a light on Shabbat? Turning on a light may very well be a din d'oraita. But muktza, at every moment, you have a problem. I have to take this, I have to take that. You left a book you want to read. On top of the book is a pen. What do you do? Right down the line, you light candles, the window is open, the wind is coming in right away. These are all dinim derabbanan. Amir lakum, you're allowed to go up an elevator on Shabbat where the guy is taking you up, taking you down. The air conditioning doesn't work. Are you allowed to tell a guy to turn it on? It's getting overly hot, it's getting overly cold. Allowed to tell her, it's all dinim derabbanan. Kashrut. No. You know very well, you could get along on one d'oraita. All you need is one set of dishes, one set of flatware. I see God is laughing. Some of the svadim just live with, believe it or not, I have svadi students, have one set of dishes. They live with glass dishes. That's all they have. One set of dishes. Glass dishes. Mind-boggling. Rabbis. Tzaddikim. One set of dishes. But we Ashkenazim, the rabbis ruined us. If not for the rabbis, you eat hot meat at 7 o'clock tonight. You watch your clock. It could even be, you know, you're learning your day now. It's a whole question whether you actually need 24 hours. Maybe night is enough. But anyway, let's say you're makpid. So you eat your milk, hot milk, 24 hours later. No? So everything we do, tarat mishpacha, shivinikiyam, again, right down the line. Halavai, we should observe the rabbanans we have. It's like the ga'anim reached the rule. We don't add any gezerat. As logical it should be. And he says, Maisim b'chal yom, people make fleishika cookies, fleishika bread, every day, day in and day out. V'lo michu b'yadam rabbatinu harishayim. And this is a goyim. And this already is a goyim speaking. But I'll show you more. This is in the goyim. Yes, yes, Jay. Well, technology, well, I'll agree with you in what we spoke about last week, that when you subjectively have to paskin, certainly that has to be taken into consideration. Certainly the example I gave you with BMT and the boy and the girl shaking hands, I challenge anyone to tell me I'm not paskining correctly, even though I may be adding a gezeira. But you have to understand the mentality. I agree with you. But meyikar adin, I'm only paskining that way because I'm choshish that if I'm matir for a guy in BMT to shake his girlfriend's hand every time he says a chiddush Torah, I'm ruining all of Yiddishkeit. Understand what I'm saying? Come on, let's be serious now. Let's be honest. But nevertheless, we can't eat any gezeirot. And if meikar adin is mutter to carry and the Erev, you don't have to worry that 30 years from now a kid is going to move away to Kalamazoo, Michigan. Listen, that's what the... I just read your Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. I just read your Tshuvat HaGoyim, but I'm going to show you many more. Avi, yes. Right? Well, that's a... They're already... It's already discussed. See, it evidently was much more widespread to make bread with milk than it is to make bread with chicken fats. So there, Taka, they say, it was much more widespread. Simply, you did it. In other words, this was something that was done day in and day out. So there, you'll already find sources that you should write on the bread, that you'll find early sources. That's why it remains a problem. Because there, it's all agreed already by the going period that you must have a siman on the bread of its milchix. The machloket over the OU is, what is a siman? Is the siman have to be directly on the bread, or is it sufficient to make a siman on the package? And that's the machloket. And since the OU today caters, remember the OU is the most widely respected hashgacha in the United States. With all the respects to the other hashgachad, every hashgacha has had major fatalities, if I may use a strong word, from their own stupidity. The OU has had problems, but because people cheated them. Jews, lo aleinu. The guy in Chicago, you know, the best dressed poultry, what happened there was a tragedy of tragedies. But that was a Jew who was out to rob money. Riches, what happened in riches was the one Jew on the higher ranking offices. And the hierarchy of riches, which is a multi-million dollar corporation, I think it's a quarter of a billion, I mean, a plant, a city block, one Jew was a thief. So there they tricked the OU. But when it comes, for instance, Satmar had terrible problems. They weren't trading properly. The guy in Brooklyn, some, I think it's the puppet or whatever, was giving the hechsher, if it's not the puppet, it's somebody else. The idiot didn't check out. They were using milchik of kalim with parva things. It was mamish up for Ashkenazim milchiks, and they were writing parva on the breadcrumbs, and it was nothing. They didn't know. They didn't check it out properly. So the most respected hashgach in America, Rabbi Heinemann, who can forget the treif boat cruise in Baltimore? It's mind-boggling that a person bizman hazeh gives hechsher to a caterer where he has two separate divisions, kosher and non-kosher, and the Mizrahi of Baltimore comes in, you know, you got to raise funds, and the terrible thing with raising funds, you got to stand on your head, because every year you got to do something different. So they came up with a boat cruise, and they neglected to tell the caterer they wanted the kosher division. So the Mizrahi goes on the boat cruise. It's a true story. It's not ancient history. It's just a few years ago. It was in the headlines of every... It was in the headlines of Mariv, Yedioth Ahronot. It was all over America. They go on the boat cruise. It's Glatreif. Rabbi Heinemann's Hashgacha, and they forgot to tell the Kaid. They took for granted people from Mizrahi are coming toward a boat cruise. Who would believe, read the Suvira about factories that make treif and kosher. So, you see, the OU is highly respected. They get a lot of business outside of modern Orthodox circles. This was explained to me. And this is why the OU has standards that go way beyond what halacha requires. All their meat is glut. You know why all their meat is glut? Because in America today, the OU economically can only survive if their meat is glut. This way Hungarians can buy it, Sfardim can buy it, it's not limited to Litvakin, and with the swing to the right, even many of the Litvakin take on chumers that their parents never dreamt about, or that their grandparents never dreamt about. So the same thing with the bread. If they're going to put an OU on the bread, you can check it out, all the sources. You must have a siman. If they're going to put an OU on the bread, people will say, yeah, but there's no siman on the bread. By looking at the bread, you can't tell it doesn't say halavi. See, if it would say halavi, I saw crackers in Israel that every cracker said halavi. That I sure. Then there's no question. Everyone in the world can agree. But here, the OU, so they solve it very, very industriously. I have to admire it. They put a K, KD. Those that know. Those that aren't makpid, they buy with a K. They don't question. My brother-in-law got all upset. He questioned. I questioned. We found that. I was in trouble because the minute I saw Arnold Bakeries, it couldn't be that half of Arnold's has an OU. Chabich Vashtanin, there has to be something beneath the surface. But my brother-in-law was all upset, so I called Rabbi Holzer. I got the information. Everybody was happy. But here with the meat, halacha lemaisa, there's no gezeira. There are no sources for this. Make all the meat cookies you want, and an intelligent person puts them aside in on the meat section. Yes, Rory. Uri, believe me, if you don't like my example with the holding of the hands, that's the rough set. If I confuse you, forget it. There I only have to tell you, I have to go beyond the question. I cannot take the kid overly seriously, you understand? He is looking shani atir isurim, that I can't do. Understand? Right there I'm saying I'm looking beyond the immediate question. And there, I know what's on the kid's mind. And I also know a boy and girl are like fire and gasoline. And you have to be very careful. And I don't want to be alive at a time when it's not like that. It's an open Gemara. New twice in Shas, told the class where. Human Sanhedrin, when they were Mavatil, the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, knew what happened, Uri. You're a London. Tell the class, you're done right. So they said, Eit Ratzon, get rid of the Yetzer Hara for sex. And what happened? All human progress came to an end. They couldn't even find a chicken that would lay an egg. No, the Breishit Rabbah. No, who can tell me over the Breishit Rabbah? Vayashem et kol ha'satav, vayinei tov miyod. What does the Breishit Rabbah say? Tov is the Yetzer Tov. Exceedingly good is the sexual urge, the Yetzer Hara. So the Medrash says, the Yetzer Hara is good, it's horrible. If not for the Yetzer Hara, man wouldn't marry, wouldn't build a house. I saw Uri walking with his wife on Thursday morning, walking towards Gibbat Mordechai at about 9 o'clock in the morning. I couldn't stop for them because it was on the highway. I didn't want to get killed, but it was a beautiful sight of a young newlywed couple talking and laughing, right or wrong, walking together. And that's beautiful. If not for the Yetzer Hara, who would marry? Jacob would marry. He's in a countdown now. He's marrying a total stranger. He's going to give her a ketuvah. You know what the ketuvah reads? That he's going to support her. I always loved the ketuvah. Afilu glima di al ketufai. The shirt off his back. He is obligating to a total stranger. He must be crazy. And that's the Midrash. No one would marry. No one would build a house. No one would have. Who the heck needs children? All they do is eat up your money. They don't let you sleep. From the day you become a father, you will never have peace of. You can never go to sleep. We can never in our house, Baruch Hashem, we never know when there's going to be a knock on the door. My wife finally was reading, trying to catch her breath, coming back from Siberia, what we went through. And the knock on the door, the grandchildren are there. It's magnificent. But it also reminds me of this. I saw the joke in a magazine. The grandparents get a letter from the children. We'd love to visit you over the Christmas holiday. And the grandmother and grandfather consult. They send back a letter. We'd love to see you. Please send us a video. Gentlemen, ladies, Baruch Hashem. This is why when it comes to the BMT question, I'm hedging my bets. Halachically, I may be wrong. Don't hang me on it. I just put that into the lecture to liven it up a little, to show you some of the problems. Sometimes I can't be true to everything I know to be true, because there are other factors. But nevertheless, if you'll ask me, if Mrs. Cotton offers you her hand, absolutely shake hands and don't embarrass a woman approaching 70, a widow, and Rabbi Soloveitchik shook her hand, and you're going to say, no, Mrs. Cotton, I can't take your hand. Okay, but let me go further. This is a goyim. Yes, Shlomo. No, I think of Si Pasach Frank, again, when you're dealing with an issue, we'll talk about. Erev is an exception because it becomes a political hot potato. When you're dealing with a political hot potato, I think he answered very intelligently. I can't get involved with the halachic matters. The great Rabbanim in New York, they know the way New York is. They know we'll talk about the problems. We haven't spoken about any of the problems yet. But he says, as far as the side Gezerah, on this I totally agree with the Menachem Kasha, you have nothing to worry about. Follow me? What you're telling me, right? Okay, Shlomo, hold off till we get to the issue, because it's a hot potato. I'll tell you who says exactly like you. I'll tell you who says exactly like you say. The Mishnah Halachot, Reb Menashe Cotton Klein, he stood his ground and said all political considerations have to be pushed away. But let me get to it, okay? But you're right, in theory you're right. But now let's do the Rishonim. I agree with you in theory. Right. No. It depends how you answer it. If you answer it because you claim it's a gezeira and it's not a gezeira, that's a ziyah fatorah. If you answer it because you say, look, and we go back to the shach of last week, despite all the sources and all the precedents, but my common sense tells me I have to answer it. You understand? Let me give you a simple example. Before 1969, Machon Gold was the only institution for students who were religious coming from Chutz Lamas to study in the state of Israel. Machon Gold had boys and girls under one roof. Machon Gold was run by the Torah Culture Department. No one can accuse the Torah Culture Department of being overly frum, overly charedi, right? They had to split it up in 69. It became no longer feasible to have boys and girls under one roof, with the sexual revolution, what I call the return to idol worship of the 1960s. And that's how BMT begins. Okay? There's an example. Now you're going to say to me, how can you come along and ask her in 69 what went on in the 1950s? Rabbi Herzog didn't object in the 1960s. Rabbi Unterman didn't object. You follow me? But that's... life has changed. And this is where we say the post-sec has to know the subjectivity of what's going on. And that's why the example I gave you, which I don't want you to hang me on, because I wasn't entirely serious, I was tongue-in-cheek. But in the example I gave you, I absolutely stand on what I would paskin when I would get such a shy in BMT, I would paskin one way. Standing in the graduate school with a 65-year-old lady, a widow, I paskin another way. You understand what I'm saying? And that's where subjectivity plays a big role. That's everything we spoke about last week. But nevertheless, you have to make clear why you're paskining. And to go and say that it's a gezeira, that you can't have boys and girls under one roof in a massive dormitory, that's absolutely false. Now what about a hotel where people check into a hotel? You don't have men and women living under one roof? You understand what I'm saying? But there were certain realities of the late 60s when you had boys and girls under one roof in an institution, Hashem Yirachem, what could happen? Okay. Hilchatz Chametz B'Matzah, Perik Hey, Halacha Chaf. The Rambam. Mutli Tein HaTavlin Ukiyotze Behem L'Toch HaBatzeik. And here we come to the classic problem. All of you know that matzah has to be baked within 18 minutes. If the water stays mixed with the matzah more than 18 minutes, it creates chimetz. Now this is a halachic concept. There is no scientific parallel for what this means. People use the word fermentation. Nothing to do. Chimetz, it's a halachic term. 18 minutes. It cannot be studied scientifically. It has to be accepted halachically. If you understand what I'm saying. Now, what about if you throw spices into the water and the flour? Maybe the spices speed up the chimetz process. And therefore, you no longer have 18 minutes. And therefore, if you taka make matzah with flour and use spice, you may very well have a halachic problem. It may very well be chametz or chametz nuksha. So the Rambam paskins, you're allowed mutli tein hatavlin vasumsumin vaketzach. He's listed spices ukiyotze behem l'toch habatzeit, and there is no problem. Look into the Ravad, or what you call the Ravid. Look into the Rabad. Right there, the Hasagat Harabad. Va'ani omer ulai lo ne'emar ela bizrizin shehayu alfin oto miyad avo lahati lechol adam kisharishot lo v'chinika atan l'shono. The Ravid takes issue with the Rambam. And the Ravid learns that, wait a minute, the Rambam's psak is wrong. Because the Ravid holds that when the Gemara, when all the early sources, it's based upon a Gemara in Pesachim Daf Lamed Vav and Aleph. But anyway, when all the early sources talking about adding spice, it's talking about Zrizin. Zrizin are those that bake quickly. Remember, we are used to hand matzahs. You don't recognize what a bracha. Excuse me. We are used to machine matzah. You don't recognize what a bracha machine matzah are. We take it for granted. Machine matzah, it's not humans. It's a factory. It's a rollers that are working. It's a production system. Everything works. One, two, three. The flour, the water, it's mixed. It goes through. Nothing waits. Everything goes as you make it. There it goes. Did you ever see a hand bakery what's involved? It's all individuals. And imagine you're a little slow. You mix the dough. You can't get it into the oven yet. The oven is not ready. You're slow in putting it in. You forget this part of the dough you didn't put in. You remember a few minutes later. Handmade matzot are infinitely more prone to halachic problems than machine-made. We forgot that. Go to a hand bakery and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's worth going once to see why we should make a shechiyanu that we have machine matzahs. Gentlemen, the Ravid comes along and says, where was the Gemara Matir, the baking of matzah with spices, when it's reason? Reason. People like you, you care, you're intelligent, you're committed to the halacha, you work hard, you're reason. But where it's not reason, some people, off, you know, normal Jews, they're not so pedantic, they're not so careful. They are not allowed, and the Rambam's psak is wrong. Look into the Magid Mishnah. The Magid Mishnah slaps the face of the Ravid. And after quoting the sugya and working it out, Vani Omer, Ein lanu l'gzag zeirat midatenu acharei dorot hagoyim. The Magid Mishnah says the Ravid is wrong, because what the Ravid is doing is being gozer gezeira. He's differentiating between Zrizin, Tanun's reason. The Gemara never mentioned it. The Ga'inim never mentioned it. And once the Ga'inic period is over, Chas v'chalila, we should add Gezerat. We should make changes. We should make new Gezerat to Yahadut. And there you have the Magid Mishnah saying clearly just what we found in the Tshuva HaGoyim. Amazing. And black and white. The Rambam is right, the Raibur is wrong. With all the logic to the Raibur. And I'm not, you know, I have to tell you, it's reason and ain't is reason. Do you ever see what happens with matzah? If you're not Zoris, you put it into the tanur, it remains there, you forget about it. The guy finally pulls it out, it starts rising, and you have all types of problems. Nafuach, you know what I'm talking about. These matzah, they check. If they're nafuach, they throw them away. They have to consider them chametz, because then you really have a problem. It's not properly baked. Nafuach already is a sign that the outside is baked, the middle isn't baked. They're real problems. This was the chashash of the Hasidim. The Hasidim didn't eat gebrachs. What was the chashash with gebrachs? That it wasn't properly baked. And that way, when you put it into the soup, the water continues the fermentation process. Or I should say, the chimutz process. I don't use the word fermentation, because it's very hard scientifically to define exactly what chimutz is, why with water it's good, and 18 minutes, and why not with fruit juice, and all these questions. When it comes to fermentation, if we're going to deal with it scientifically, we can reach different conclusions. We have to deal with the Kabbalah, with the chimutz. But can't make gezeirat. Absolutely can't make gezeirat. And this is the greatness of Mishin Matzah, that all these problems that haunted us halachically don't exist. I can tell you even more, that if someone here is a chassid and doesn't eat gebrachs on Pesach, the truth of the matter is that with Mishin Matzah, the problem of gebrachs doesn't exist, because everything is baked uniformly. With hand matzah, the problem of gebrachs still may exist today, but not with Mishin Matzah. But nevertheless, a chassid is not going to change his practice, because it's already ingrained that you don't eat gebrachs. But that's a second example, and that's a beautiful example. And the Magid Mishnah, so clear, so black and white. Yes, Uri. What I'm about to say now, maybe a newlywed shouldn't hear, but go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Right. Well, the Vilna Gaon would have heart failure from your question, because the Vilna Gaon insisted on having Knedlach say the night. He felt exactly like you, that not eating gebrachs on Pesach makes as much sense as dancing a kazatska with Meir Tzidang. You're absolutely right. Can't do any better than that. You don't want me to defend the Hasidim? Do I have to suffer? The fact is, Uri, if you want to cry, you're looking at a Jew who hasn't eaten gebrachs in 33, this will be my 34th Pesach without gebrachs, because I married a woman who happens to be from a rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, heinous, brutus, depraved, degenerate, debauched, sect of Belze Hasidim. And my mother-in-law, Zichrono Levracha, I once put a drop of matzah into the soup. It was like eating chometz on Pesach. Go and explain to them halachically that Uri quoted the Vilna Gaon who ate matzah kuftaot. It's brought down already in La Halacha, in the Maisa Rav, in the Vilna Gaon. You don't have to take my word for it. You don't have to take the Rav's word for it. Look into the Maisa Rav. You know what I'm talking about. It's brought down Halacha. But it's fine. Believe me, you're right. But what can I do? I want to stay happily married. Which leads me to my next point. Show you another source. Gentlemen, a woman makes or breaks a man. Motzei matzah. All of you know what Chazal have to say. And it's the truth. I don't want to offend the ladies here. But when a woman nags a man, he's finished. When a woman is soft and understanding and compromising, the man has a life of gold. Gentlemen, how is this reflected in the halacha? No? I want to introduce the concept. Such silence here. No? One of the halachot, which are very unfair, but I have to say, very honest. Katlanit. Can anyone tell me what a katlanit is? Okay. Katlanit. A woman knew. What do you say? What do you say, Abraham? You're watching too much CNN, I think, with Babbage. She's using no. Don't overstate the case. Don't overstate the case. When a woman is married to two men, and the two men drop dead, so we say that this woman can't marry a third time, because we are very worried that the men are dropping dead because she is aggravating them. Okay? In those days, they didn't dream of what can happen in modern times with the refining shalom. Today, it's a different world, but in those days. Now, I have to say, a woman can turn around and say, why isn't there the reverse? Why don't we call a man a katlan? In other words, this seems a little unfair. But the truth of the matter is, if you know human relations, it's so true. A woman, when she eats into a man, the man is finished. A man eating into a woman gets involved with her kids and tells the old geezer to go fly a kite, it doesn't have the same impact. At least that's what my life experience has taught me. Now, what do we do? By the way, I have to tell you, halacha lemaisa, it's very hard to find a katlanit. Can anyone tell me why? Because halacha lemaisa, what do? If we can blame... Yeah, go ahead, Gadi, explain. Right, if you blame it, obviously no one drops dead. No one yet dropped dead wearing a sign, my wife aggravated me to death. He drops dead of heart failure, cancer, all the diseases perhaps that are slightly aggravated by aggravation. So what we do is as follows. We paskin la halacha that if we can blame it on disease, on illness, the woman is not considered a katlanit. There's no question if you take the Babbage case, if she does it one more time, I would say anyone who marries her a third time has to have his head examined. I mean, that really is a fool. But okay. Hilchat Isuri Biyah, Perikaf Aleph, Halacha Lamed Aleph. Isha, I have to say, in between the lines, I always admire American society. So much was, with so many tragedies while I was there, with all due respects, the weather is nothing to laugh at. Old people died from cold weather. So many people fell and broke their limbs. People I know broke hips, broke wrists. I mean, you have no idea. And I understand it's very bad again now. And not only that, what happened in Los Angeles and there too, no one knows where it's going to end because there are more tremors and more tremors. If anyone in a seichel, they'd evacuate all of L.A., give it back to the Indians, and move elsewhere. Because it's crazy to rebuild again if in a few more years, God have mercy, had that happened at 8:31 in the morning instead of 4:31. You understand what the death toll would have been with the highways? This way it happened 4:31 a.m. Only a Meshuggah is out driving at 4:31 a.m. in the morning. But imagine 4 hours later what would have happened. So it's with all the tragedy in America, the only thing that was on the news was the Babbage case. It's amazing. I admire a country that had all their tragedies. All that interests them is that case. It's amazing. Avunz gesagt that we could get some of our tragedies off the news and have shtuyot to worry about. Hilchat Isuri Biya, Perek Hafalav, Halacha Lamed Alef. Ishas and Ishait, Lishtein Hashim, Vimeitu. Lishlishi, Lotin Asait. She's not allowed to marry a third time. She has a din of a katlanit. However, Vim Nisait, Lotin Asait. But if she married, she's allowed to remain married. And even if there's only wiskedushin, you make the chuppah. So that when it comes to a katlanit, there is a din of lachatchila, and there's a din of bidiyavad. And this is the halacha. It's based upon the sources, based upon the Rishonim and the Shas and Paiskim and the earliest sources, the Gainim, and this is the way the Rambam paskens the halacha, and everyone agrees. Fine. We take a look in the Tshuva HaRivash, Shelatim Tshuva Reb Yitzchak Ben Sheshet. This is the family perfect. We're dealing here with one of the great Svadik Meshivim of the Rishonic period, the Rivash, one of his collection of Trivarai, and every major topic, there isn't a major topic where you don't go back to the Rivash. I mean, if you take the topic of civil marriage, every discussion has to begin with the Rivash. And there are many other Trivarai, one of the greatest Paiskim, living at a time of Gerish Sfat and to Algiers, I mean, at the terrible time before the Gerish, they ran away. One of the end of the Rishonim, the great Rivash. So, Tshuva, Reish Mem Aleph, Rama, you can remember it very easily. And he gets the question. Sha'alta lahodiyacha daiti binyan katlanit im amrinan the imni seik lo tetzei kedat harambam. Do we really pasuk like the Rambam? In other words, evidently people wanted to be mafmi. This woman's a katlanit. She already killed two men. Maybe if she marries a third, break it up, force her away. And he says that it appears to me that the Rambam is absolutely right, because the lashon of the Gemara is lo tinasei. When the Gemara discusses a katlanit, the Gemara uses the lashon lo tinasei. You'll see all the sources in the Tshuva. And what does lo tinasei mean? Lachatina. It doesn't apply to the avad. Lo tinasei if they come to ask. But if they already married, they can remain together. And then the Rivash throws in these unbelievable words. And even though perhaps in your community you're troubled by it, and perhaps in your community you want to add a gezerah, ein lano lahosif al gezerot shel difrayim. And here you have the Rivash, black and white. We cannot add gezerot bisman hazeh. We cannot add to the Gainim. We cannot add to the Rishonim. Everything we have to observe. What we don't have, Chas v'chalila, we cannot come along and add on our own. And I'll give you one more example. There are many examples, many discussions of this problem, but I'll give you one more example. Yes, Gadi, I'll give you an example that's in your backyard. Yes. The Pre-Chadash. Now, Orech Chaim. Taf Nun Gimel. It's your question right here. Pre-Chadash. And all of you know that when it comes to Pesach, the state of Israel where the Ashkenazim and the Sfardim come in together, the greatest problem on Pesach, Kitniyot. And here we have a terrible halakhic problem. Because all of you know the Gemara says openly that rice is not machmitz. If you can use rice on Pesach, it's an open Gemara, it's a machlekit in the Gemara, we paskin l'halacha, you can use rice. If you can use rice, how did you ever dream up asering kitniyot legumes? What can be wrong with having string beans on Pesach? What can be wrong with having corn on Pesach? Now this is, what can be wrong with having soybeans on Pesach? And you all know. Ashkenazim, Sfardim. Look into the Pre-Chadash, and he was a Sfardi, Turkish origins, then comes to Israel. Taf Nun Gimel, Sif Katan Aleph. And let me explain it. And you see, we don't know why until today. We don't know for sure. It's an amazing thing, because on Pesach, this is one of our biggest problems. You marry a Sfardia, for the sake of argument, you marry Rav Ovadia's granddaughter, and Rav Ovadia invites you to his Seder, he eats rice, Leil HaSeder. What are you going to do? It's a serious problem. Baruch Hashem in Israel, every intermarriage we have adds to Kibbutz Galia, to the beauty of the coming home of the Jewish people. In Chutz Laretz, when you have intermarriage with Goyim, it's the end of the Jewish people. Here, when Ethiopians marry Americans, and Canadians marry Russians, Russians marry Algerians, and Yosef Mendelevich marries Kahatcha Sarusi, this is Yemot HaMashiach. Okay?
So it's a real problem. So one of the reasons given is we have a concept of cornbread. What does cornbread mean? You know, you grind the corn, it's supposed to be very healthy, and you make cornbread. It's supposed to be healthy. If you make cornbread, so maybe that's why people don't eat kitniyot, because when you have the flour, it resembles regular wheat flour. And people will think that if you can eat this flour, you can eat wheat flour, and chas v'chalila, they'll eat chametz gomor on Pesach. And this is one of the svarot given for not eating kidneyot on Pesach. What I told you, you should know, it's Yukri Beirah, because this is the most basic reason. You know what the Pri Chadosh says? V'zet teima, shachash in estam ha-talmud, shenigzog zeirot midatenu. And he says, how can it be? This cannot be the reason. We cannot make gezeirot on our own. With all the fact that cornbread looks like regular corn flour, and in Hachinami, if you go, you can buy corn flour. Corn flour taka looks like regular flour. The difference is, corn flour is a little bit more yellow. They have soya flour. Some people eat soya bread. You go into a health store, you have soya bread, all types of these different breads. But if this is why it's a gezeira, how can we make a gezeira? That's what you said, Gadi. Exactly the Pri Chadosh. Baruch Shekivanta. Now, I'll end off the Pri Chadosh. I'll end off the class with this. I just want to end off the whole Pri Chadosh, not leave you in the middle. All I need out of the Pri Chadosh is this part. He goes on to discuss another reason why it can very well be that we don't use the legumes on Pesach. And here I have to tell you, if not for the Israeli army, and I always... My wife always admires, whatever I do in life, I try to learn from it halachically. Like I told you, this last trip to America, on the plane coming back, I try to evaluate, what did I gain out of this trip? And this women's prayer group was an eye-opener to me. When I saw this Hasidic Rebbe's daughter, and she has from children and grandchildren and whatnot, and her nephew is a Hasidic Rebbe, going to be one of the big rabbis of the next generation, it opened my eyes. I learned something. Tell me, what did I learn in the Israeli army? Gentlemen, what did I do in the Israeli army? I had a plum position. I was a lecturer in the rabbinate's Midrashat Toranit, which was their highest school for teaching Judaism, where the soldiers came to us and chose us. We didn't have to go and force them to listen to us. Fine. Before Pesach, every year for so many years, I got called up, Mipsa Kashrut. Thousands upon thousands of rabbis called up to kasher out the Israeli army. One of the things we did before the actual kashering, we worked 2 whole days before the day of kashering, cleaning the rice. The Israeli army consists of many Svardim. When Svardim don't have rice, they are not happy. That is a staple. It's like taking away a Hershey bar from an American. Believe me, when I came in Aliyah, all I missed was baseball, the New York Times, and Hershey chocolates. So you have to clean the rice. You know what it means, cleaning rice? The Sfardim taught me how. You ever clean rice? You'd spread a beautiful white tablecloth. You spread the rice on the tablecloth, and you look. And now I found out what the Pri Chadosh is talking about. You know what the Pri Chadosh is talking about? And it's true. In farms, you don't grow the legumes far from the wheat. Many times the legumes are grown adjacent to the wheat fields. The winds blow grain back and forth. And you can find among the rice, among the legumes, you can find husks of hay, of real grain. And chas v'chalila, you cook it on Pesach, unknown to you, there's chametz inside. And now there's one halachic problem. Saul, what's the problem? Mashiach. If there wouldn't be the problem of Mashu and Pesach, you wouldn't have a problem. Follow me? As a matter of fact, I often said the army could very well solve the problem by cooking all the rice before Pesach and freezing it and taking it out, but the Sfadim would rebel because if it's not fresh, you cannot freeze rice, in their opinion. In my opinion, freeze all the rice. I don't give a darn. My wife makes rice, freezes it, you take it out of the freezer, put it into a microwave, replenish it on. But before Pesach, we could solve the problem. On Pesach, there's no way. And this makes sense. Nevertheless, the Prichodesh is bothered by what Gadi said. With all that we say, Ein Gozrin Gezeirat. And that's why Paschus Lahalacha, and this is minig among all the Sfadim, those of you that are Sfadim can bear me out. You know what Elecher from Sfadim do? You know what they do? Boaz, after Purim, they set a little corner aside and they go through the rice 3 times. It's right there in the Prichadish. You check it 3 times on 3 different occasions, you're allowed to cook the rice on Pesach. No, what's the klal? Help me out. Lo nitna Torah, la malachei hasharet. Exactly. And that's Minig Yisrael, and the Sfadim can eat rice and eat legumes as long as they cook it before Pesach, or as long as they're mavarer it, and if they want to be medagdeg, the old pious Sfadic women would do it 3 times between Purim to Pesach, and that's exactly the words of the Prichadish. But it's another example of Ein Gozrin Gezeirot Liacha Hatimat HaTalmud Liacha HaRishonim Lacha HaGonim. The Goyim already said it. What are we to say? Let me just reiterate, then I'll open it if there are any questions. I know you have to eat supper, and my energies are ebbing, and the tape is ticking. First of all, for those of you who didn't see, I have another copy of the Al HaTshuva with a dedication to the Rav, and I'm very proud of this. The first volume of the Rav to be published after his death, and the first volume dedicated to the Rav after his death, and I don't think anyone will find fault with my dedication, whether they're right or left. I think I've summarized all his students' feelings in this dedication. At least I can tell you the family was moved to tears, and if they're moved to tears, certainly I'm moved to tears. And I thank God that I had the skut to be able to do this, to raise the money, the vision, to push it, contribute some of my own money to it. And I never realized what an impression that made until at the parlor meeting the other night, the person who introduced me began by saying, you all know what teachers make in Israel, nevertheless. Young people never worry about making money, only worry about knowing Torah, being great in Torah, and great in Yirat Shemayim. That ultimately is all that counts in life, looking to Pirkei Avot. Young people, what did we do today? First of all, I said a few words in last week's lecture. I'm so overwhelmed by the words of the Raman and the Shach. And the truth is, if a person is a Yirei Shemayim, he's the Moediatra, he's the Posek, he understands the circumstances, and it would be very foolish for us to intervene long distance. If the person is a Yirei Shemayim, be samach on him. Bein l'kula, bein l'hachmir. If he's a Bahachi, he knows what he's paskening. If it sounds way out, avomakom hinichula avatavlit kaderbo, and the example I gave you last week with the Yayayayach, with Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, with the Menachem Kasha, it's overwhelming. But that's what we say every generation can add to the Torah Shabbat Pem. If you remember the Rebbe's lecture on Korach, how I developed it a year or two ago, you'll understand what I'm saying. We don't make chidush from without, chas v'chalila, from within the framework, mokom hinichula avatavlit kaderbo. Then we got involved today. The whole class was dedicated to Gezeirah. And I showed you when it comes to Paskin Yishela, we cannot make Gezeirah.